I'm very delighted indeed to see everyone this evening. As Mary's actually been staying up at the monastery for the last few days, and as she was driving us down this evening, she said, "Well, Thanksgiving, there's going to be a few people tonight, you know, it's all right." And so I was expecting just three or four of us, so this is splendid to see everyone taking this opportunity to include a little bit more of an explicitly spiritual element in the Thanksgiving arena. For those of you who weren't here last week, this is the second of a series of three little sessions on compassion in action. CIA, in brief, as Mary's been pointing out. Joined the CIA for 3 weeks. And so last week we were exploring the basis of compassion, what that is, and some fundamental practices for that. So we want to extend that a little bit this time, and particularly talking about obstructions to compassion, because as we know, just having the idea to do something or be some way is not the whole story. You just can't decide, "Oh well, I'm now going to be a compassionate person, or I'm going to stop being angry. You know, okay, I've given up anger from today on, that's it." You know, we can decide all that we like, but the decision doesn't carry the whole vote. So one of the things that so basically understanding that, you know, we can have the idea or the intention to practice compassion, even if we understand what it truly is, but then there's often, you know, habits or attitudes that get in the way, that obstruct that. And so hopefully we'll look at that this evening and help to clarify that area and see ways that we can work with that and transform that. Last week I was talking about the compassion, and there are several words for it in the scriptural language of Pali. One is karuna, which I talked about last week. Another is anukampa, which is less commonly used. And the verb kampati means to tremble or to shake, to quiver. And so anukampa means is often translated by the phrase to tremble for the welfare of all beings. So that was this lovely little phrase, trembling for the welfare of all beings, which is, in English, it's obviously difficult to catch the precise connotation, because I love the way that it actually embodies that quality of resonating, actually, like trembling. So maybe resonating with a concern for the welfare of all beings, or resonating with all beings. Because primarily the Buddhist understanding of true compassion is a profound empathy. It's an active empathy with other beings, and particularly with their states of suffering that beings can experience, both, you know, ourselves and others. So then to consider what is it that obstructs compassion? How do we find ourselves getting lost? Because in Buddhist psychology, to experience compassion, or the quality of compassion, is not a state of suffering. So that the heart is open to the suffering of another, but you are not suffering because of that. So this is what we're aiming at. That's the principal goal, is to find out how we can realize that and embody that. So the things that we can find obstructing that true quality of profound empathy, but without suffering ourselves, is that we do suffer ourselves. That when we open our hearts to others and the suffering of others, we get swept up in that, and we get caught up in and swept away in the difficulty of others, and then we, and because of the feeling of of that identification with another suffering, then we can find ourselves feeling it's resistant or feeling too vulnerable, that we can't let ourselves feel that it's too dangerous or too harmful. So we shut down or armor ourselves or distance ourselves. Another way that we find that that quality of compassion sort of obstructed or occluded is just our ordinary mental habits, the way that we relate to things. We might have that idea of wanting to be different or seeing that it'd be better to have this quality of profound empathy, but we're just our habits of relating are so strong that quality of true empathy never really gets near the surface, because we're drawn into the kind of reactive patterns, either of shutting down or of and distancing oneself, hardening the heart, or of getting swept up and identifying with. And the third habit that we can have is that of just plain ordinary selfishness. Like, I got, who needs compassion? I've got mine. I'm okay. Tough luck. And that basic sort of discarding of the feelings of others, not really caring, because as they, I don't know if that Peter Sellers film ever made it over here. It's called I'm All Right, Jack. But the basic principle is, I've got mine. If you haven't got yours, tough luck. I'm okay. So the I'm all right, Jack attitude. So I'll assume that that those of us who've gathered here this evening are probably working on the basis of the first two of those, that we would like to have a little more in the way of compassion. We're not trying to cultivate total selfishness. And to see, well, what are these two, these habits, these ways that we we find that compassionate principle being obstructed. So the first kind, the first way that we get caught up is through this quality of identification with the suffering of others. And what you can call the becoming tendency. We get caught in that painful feeling and we identify with it. So this can be in many different ways that we get caught in it or that we work with it. So firstly, in terms of our attitude, it can just be a simple, it's just so painful to be exposed to the suffering of others. And in Buddhist psychology, they talk about, with wholesome qualities, they talk about the near enemies that they have. So that the near enemy of compassion is pity, or say being entangled in the state of suffering of another. So the near enemy of something like equanimity would be callousness or indifference. So it's like it looks like it, but it's actually an unwholesome quality. So I was contemplating this, and this whole element of say being caught up in the suffering of others, and I remembered when I was a small child, I was actually forbidden to watch Bambi because my mother knew that it would take weeks for me to recover. Seriously, I was in my 30s before I ever saw Bambi. It was on an in-flight movie thing, one of those planes where you have like four or five channels to choose from. And I thought, yeah, I've never seen... I saw the cartoon channel, I thought, I've never seen Bambi. And then I did manage to kind of contain myself, but I was watching it, thinking, a 35-year-old Buddhist monk, I should hold it together. But I could see why my mother didn't want me to watch it, because I would get so tearful when I saw any creature that was suffering, and she knew that I was, Bambi was going to be way too much, and I just wasn't going to recover. I remember there was a record, a little 45 that my sister had, that was called "The Little Dog Cried," and I wasn't allowed to listen to that either. It was like forbidden. It was about this guy who died, and his dog went to the grave and was crying on the grave. It's like, no way. And she said when she first had the insight into this, when we lived on a little farm, I was apparently watching the TV one day with my sisters, and it was Heidi. You familiar with the story of Heidi? So there were my sisters sort of sitting there kind of glued to the screen. You're watching with great interest. And my mother saw that I was sitting there too, and it's like tears just pouring down my face. This kind of some little element of heartbreak in the story. So I was on a sort of regime in my childhood because I would suffer so much because of just feeling very strongly for the pain of others. So I think we can all relate to that. So this is one way, just like sheer identification with the suffering of others. So there's a beauty in that openness, but also we can only cry so much, Or just as someone was saying to me earlier this evening, you can empathize so much and really feel for another's suffering, but sometimes, it is so painful to live in that degree of pain, or also we feel that we're supposed to keep up with the other person's suffering, and they're demanding or asking us to kind of keep helping them, supporting them, and you realize this is a bottomless pit. It's like a feeding the habit of an addict. It's like there's no end here, and even though I'm giving and giving and giving and giving and giving, I'm getting exhausted, and that we can feel it's very. We don't want to be hard-hearted because the person's begging and asking for our help. So we're drawn in by that pain, and then we find ourselves burned out and then resentful because the other keeps saying, "Help me, help me, help me." So that this way of getting drawn in and feeling like we're being terribly cruel or selfish to even shut down a little bit to others, or to say, "Look, enough." Whereas I was saying to a friend earlier this evening, it's like when you realize it gets to that point, sometimes, like working with an addict, it's like even if they say, if you love me, you'd pay attention, or you'd listen, or you wouldn't withdraw. But you say, but just like working with an addict, it's like, yeah, it's because I love you that I am withdrawing. It's because I do care that I'm not going to constantly feed your need for being comforted. So another way that we sort of get away from the feeling of compassion is the genuine feeling of compassion is in spiritual practices, kind of meditation practices. I remember reading a book by a guy called Anthony de Mello. I think he's a Catholic meditation teacher, and he said one of the key ways that we escape from reality is through spiritual practice. This is a Catholic priest talking. And so that there's a strange way whereby we can feel like we're doing something. Like, okay, I'm going to do compassion practice. And we sort of have a whole set of phrases that we do, or we visualize Guanyin or Chen Rezig, or we have a whole sort of a battery of stuff that we are engaging in. And so that our sense of, I should be doing something to be more compassionate. So we're engaging in that. But it can be quite unconsciously just that we're feeding on the doingness, and we're fending off that sense of fear of opening to the suffering of another, or that sense of vulnerability by in a way creating a distraction, like a legal reason to not be attending to that, because I'm doing compassion, I'm paying my dues, I'm practicing this, and so that. Even though we might be going through the motions of a practice, we can in a way be sort of deflecting our attention from that real openness that is going to be most helpful. Another of the ways that we get lost is through intellectualizing or verbalizing, and I hesitate. I mean, I'm a compulsive verbalizer and explainer. I often feel like I'm an answering machine. They sort of come at me with your question, and I'll come up with an answer. Even if I don't know anything about it, I'll come up with an answer. You know, I'm infamous for the capacity to always have an answer for everything. And so, that just being taking refuge in explaining, or so when we meet with the compassion of another being, either we explain things to ourselves, or we get into explaining or intellectualizing to another, and that. And even though on one level we can feel that we're being helpful, we're sort of, that we're actually disconnecting. We're even though you're there, maybe face to face, but you're actually protecting yourself or not actually really allowing the situation to be truly known by coming up with solutions for it. And I remember very vividly an account that a friend of ours gave to me of, he was having a very... intense setu with his wife at the time, and she was expressing all these sort of, you know, grievances or difficulties or struggles, and he was sitting there sort of very patiently sort of trying to respond to everything that she was asking and saying and all these different difficulties she was describing. And then suddenly sort of mid-sentence she stopped and said, "You think just like a man. Stop answering my questions and listen to me." And he's like, and he's even more of a compulsive explainer than I am. So. And it just completely knocked him sideways. And that's why he was recounting it to me. It's like it was such a different perspective, because it's like, well, no, she's got a question. I answer the question. It's the end of the problem, right? No, wrong. And that he had been, they'd been going on for like, you know, an hour and a half, and he hadn't been noticing. Well, it had been going on for like 10 years, actually. And he hadn't been noticing that was always, you know, if there was a problem, he would come up with an answer, an intellectual or verbal thing that would fill in the missing piece. But that was actually, you know, what his wife needed was not to be answered, not to have it explained to her, but just to be received, to be heard. And so when he passed that little gem on to me, I remember going away going, oh dear. Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. Because it's, you know, and he wasn't saying it because it was like, this is something you need to know, Amaro, but it was anyway. So. And been incredibly helpful, and so I find that just seeing the way that we do, particularly those of us who are very verbal, intellectual types, the way we fend off that other, we fend off others by seemingly kind of also connecting, but you know, kind of guarding ourselves in different ways. And then the last, the most, probably the most important of the ways that we sort of mishandle or that genuine quality of compassion is occluded, is through activity, through doing stuff. And so that even though we might have a feeling of being with a situation or seeing some kind of harm being done and or somebody in a difficult state and we're moved to do something, often it's that we're dispelling that feeling of I want to do something, I want to help this person to stop suffering, but we get lost in the doingness of it. If you understand what I mean, but that sheer I'm out there, I'm doing, at least I'm doing something, and that even though good stuff can be done in that respect, still we can be not really allowing ourselves find this genuine quality of compassion because of just say getting so busy or seeing the goodness in terms of the stuff that gets done. You know, we're scoring points because of, you know, so many things that I did or so many people that are helped and people are thankful. And it's not, I don't want to put down the goodness of work that is done, but there's also is to look at what's driving it within us. What's the agent that's pushing it along? And oftentimes it's that feeling of I'm fending off this sense of my own incompleteness or my own insufficiency or that or the painfulness of another's suffering by just piling up the amount of doingness. I've often quoted a statistic I found really quite amazing. This was from probably about 8 or 10 years ago now in Britain. They did a survey. They were doing a review of the social services, a very, very large social service in Britain. And so they did this in-depth psychological profile for the thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of social workers around the country. And they found, to their amazement and horror, that something like 90% of social workers in Britain were almost compulsively needy of the affection of others. Like, you're virtually clinically dependent on receiving affection and approval and affirmation from others. So they thought, what? 90% of our people are sort of, you know, almost hospitalizable or certainly needing treatment, you know, because of their need to be loved by others. So do we have to kind of scrap the entire social services and find a whole bunch of people who don't need that? But it was really striking. Yeah, these, you know, the people, all the social workers do a great job. They really are there for so many people in need. But that was shocking and striking to them to see that how much the driving force was to be able to get it to be having a job whereby over and over again during the course of the day you're getting, oh, you're so helpful, I'm so glad that you're here, this is really good, you're so kind, you're so lovely, I really like it when you come to visit me, and this is so helpful, what to do without you, etc., etc., etc. I mean, I enjoy that as a monk, you know. I get a lot of that, and I appreciate it. Maybe that's, I'm one of the 90%, you know, with compulsively needy of other people's affection and approval. But at least that, and knowing that, was enabled them to sort of craft things so that they were aware of that in the population. Also, another of the things that we along with that, this general sort of busyness and doingness that comes with compassionate action, another of the ways that we can radically lose track of that beautiful and pure sense is just through getting swept up into a particular project or some issue, and we end up opposing things or harming things. In support of your kind of compassionate action or your kind of noble intent, you then get swept up into obstructing others or harming others. And I think probably all of us have had the experience of feeling a great deal of kind of negativity and anger and conflict and struggle in terms of in situations of pursuing noble goals. Is this strange to anyone? You know, peace marches that are, you know, extremely unpeaceful. You know, people are dedicated to saving the environment and out of the love of the natural order, and yet driven by intense degrees of anger and aversion and personal hatred for such like, you know. So it's, you know, you can see there's a noble intent or a love of life or love of living things and others that's behind it, but it can easily, if we lose track of what we're doing, get drawn into states of great harming. So like people murdering doctors at abortion clinics, or people just cultivating hatred for loggers. You see someone as a logger, and then it's like the devil incarnate. And that especially in this area, there's a lot of conflict between these different groups of our society, the sort of eco-friendly types and the logging types, and that we can easily seem to be like utterly opposed. And so even though the initial motivation can be very noble and compassionate, yes, you want to save the forest, you want to save the atmosphere, you want to respect the life of the woods, but then you want to preserve human life, and so then you, by a succession of small increments, we suddenly find ourselves filled with rage and conflict and anger against some perceived enemy, them, whoever the them might be. So, these are all ways that we get swept up in the kind of becoming side of mishandling the compassionate intention. The other angle, which is, there's a little bit less to say about, which can be equally harmful, is sort of more of a problem in sort of explicitly spiritual circles. And this is the cutting off, so that we're, shutting down the whole sort of compassion. We're dealing with, we're sort of missing that compassionate spirit by just sort of shutting down. Either A, because we're just plain selfish, of course I'm more important than you. Tough luck. Well, another side of it, which is more common in spiritual circles, is the sort of taking the kind of ultimate reality escape clause, like saying, "Well, it's all empty. What other beings? All beings are empty, all beings are void of self. Who's there to be compassionate for? You're on your own. If you exist, you're on your own." And so that this is a it's understandable, but particularly where you have these sort of very high-minded, ultimate reality-type teachings, we can take refuge in that kind of principles, a transcendent principle. And even though we don't realize it, even though we're taking it very lofty, it doesn't seem anything like, I'm more important than you. It seems far more valid than that. But still, it can be a basically selfish motivation. It's like Ram Dass used to always use this example of saying, people would say, we're all one. You do the dishes. You say, okay, and they say, well, okay, we're all one, okay, I'll do the dishes, I'll take your wallet, If we're all one, then the contents of your wallet are also available for me, right? So that we can misuse that sort of Vajra perspective, and in a way we can see that as true, if we have these deep insights into emptiness or not self, we can see there really is no self, no other. And that if that insight is genuine, then it's not, the heart is not being cut off from anything, but it can be just taking that principle, and then that self-centered attitude is co-opting that and saying, hey, this is a great escape clause. It means I don't have to bother, I don't have to think about you, I don't have to feel this, because hey, you don't really exist, and neither do I. Whee! So I can shut down. I can not feel. So the principal ways that of working with these And just to speak about briefly, and then we'll have a meditation period, is, say, primarily recognizing these self-centered reflexes, these different ways that we do. And you can see that they're either protecting the, you know, either the feeling of identification with another suffering, that I am that is mine, that belongs to me, the feeling of self identifying with that, or the feeling of I kind of shutting down and protecting itself, you know, barricading it. So that the whole direction of the practice, the meditation, needs to be in how can we cultivate the right effort without that being based on the feelings I and me and mine. Does that make sense? So that the distortions, or the way that that compassion really gets occluded, is that the stronger the sense of me is, stronger the sense of self and other, then the more the heart is not able to genuinely relate from that basis of true compassion. And that the less there is a sense of self dominating the picture, then the more clearly we can function. So that one of the practices I was mentioning last week is this quality of listening to the mind, listening to other beings, and so that it's in terms of right effort, what we're aiming to do is to clearly recognize that the arising of those of the habit of identifying with another suffering, or the habit of shutting down, seeing those self-based inclinations arising. And if they arise, then to consciously let go of that. Or to be conscious, you know, even before they arise, to be aware of that being a source of difficulty. And to restrain those sort of self-based urges from arising. And then to consciously cultivate this quality of listening. Listening to our own thoughts, listening to our own moods, listening to others. And on that, from that basis of deep listening, from really attending to each other, to then allow the heart to respond, guided by its attunement to the time and the place and the situation, so that there's a readiness to respond. So sometimes when we talk in these terms, or like we talk about, say, listening or just attending or practicing wisdom, then it can seem to represent a kind of passivity, a kind of, you're just sort of being a data reception point, you know, feeling, hearing, knowing, and so it doesn't. It always seems as though there's an outgoing element from that. But one of the aspects of the Buddhist teaching that I find very helpful is just in the word that the Buddha used to describe himself, or to refer to himself, was Tathagata. And this is made up of two pieces. This is a little Pali lesson. The word tat or tata means thus or such. And the word gata means to go. And agata means to come. The A at the beginning makes a negative. So for centuries, millennia, there's been the debate. Did the Buddha really mean tat agata, thus come, or tata gata, thus gone? Gone to suchness or come to suchness? Is he totally here or is he totally gone? Now, the Buddha was a great wordsmith, and he loved double meanings and wordplays. And so my pet theory, founded on no great knowledge whatsoever, but my theory is that he deliberately chose an ambiguous term. Because when we talk in terms of wisdom or of letting go and these kind of things, sometimes it feels like we're trying to enter into some sort of passive state. It's like that which is totally transcendent, gone. You know, nothing is self, everything is empty. But the other element is that of immanence, along with the transcendence, the immanence of being totally here, that the Buddha principle is not just totally transcendent, it's also completely immanent, that wise knowing quality of our own heart. It's necessarily immanent, it's attuned to the present, and it's totally connected to all things. So that when we're looking at this quality of true wisdom, then it's not just a sort of abstracted or remote sort of position of observing or listening and disconnection. It's both that transcendent quality, but there's also this utter connection, which is where the compassion element comes in, because it's implying that when the Buddha principle is truly clarified, then there's not only that utterly transcendent view of things, there's also that connectedness and the response that comes forth from that, the way that we relate to life. You need to have the wisdom element first of truly kind of letting go and you know, working on your own life first, and then from that then comes from that utterly clear basis, that open center, then there comes forth action which is harmonious towards others. So the last thing I'll say on this is, there's a very well-known little discourse which outlines the Buddha's own view on working on yourself and helping yourself and helping others, and it's called the Discourse of the Bamboo Acrobats, and there's this street acrobats in India. Some of you might have encountered such people when you've been travelling there. But in one of the kind of standard street theatre things to do is you have a guy holding up a pole, and then a little child will climb up the pole and do sort of acrobatic tricks while the pole's sort of being balanced in the air. And if you've ever seen a book called A Fine Balance by Rohit Mistry, the novel, on the front cover there's at the bottom of the cover there's a finger, and on the top of the finger there's this pole, and at the top of the pole there's this little kind of 5-year-old girl doing the performance as a photograph. And so in the time of the Buddha there was such a little acrobatic troupe, and the little girl in this was called Frying Pan. Her name was Frying Pan. And so then the senior acrobat said, "Climb up the pole, little Frying Pan, and if you get up, you climb up the pole, and you know, you do your performance, and then you do a good job, and you come down safely from the pole. When you're up there, I'll look after you, and then you look after me, and that way we'll do a good performance, and we'll get a good fee, and you'll come down safely from the pole." And she says, "That's not the way it is at all. That's not how it should be, Master. When I climb up the pole, I should look after myself. I look after my job, and you look after yourself. You look after your job. That's the way that I'll get up the pole, I'll do a good performance, we'll get a good fee, and I'll come down safely." So if when the Buddha recounted this story, he said, in this case, the little girl, she was right, and her teacher was wrong. That it's like, she was right in saying that I look after myself, you look after yourself, and then that's the way that we'll actually do a good job. Because, you know, if we're thinking of the other first and ourselves second, we're always kind of slightly disconnected from what we need to do. So it's like the guy, like, you've got to balance that pole on your finger. Don't worry about her. You just... you just pay close attention to that pole resting on your finger. That's what you got to do. And so then the Buddha says, this is how we truly, in order to benefit others, by practicing the four foundations of mindfulness, we truly benefit ourselves. By benefiting ourselves, we truly benefit others. That's how we bring about the best with our lives. So he outlines that very clearly, that yes, we do need to pay close attention to our own insight, our own practice, But the purpose of doing that is not just to benefit ourselves, but the natural result of that is benefiting others into the bargain.